Hello, thanks for joining us. You're listening to a special hour of Prairie Public Presents. I'm Ashley Thornburg. This week, we're airing an hour-long look at the kinds of stories that tend to be among the hardest to tell. Stories of war, training, combat, injuries, recovery, and the long-lasting effects on soldiers and their families. We're airing excerpts from Project Unpack, Telling Stories, Creating Community, Understanding the Legacies of War. It's a one-year program funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities, aimed at helping veterans and their families share their stories. And we start today with Joshua Zeiss. He grew up on a small family farm near Langdon, North Dakota. He had a couple of starts with college and at a career in early adulthood, but eventually joined the North Dakota Army National Guard as a medic. And we start his story on the day the commander of the 817th Sappers, an engineer company out of Jamestown, told Zeiss his life was about to change forever.
I know exactly what happened that day. He comes up to me. He's like, "Hey, Zeiss, guess what? You're going to war." Blood started to run, getting shocky. And he said, "Guess what? I guarantee you're going to see combat." And I was like, "Sir, can I take the rest of the day off?" I left the armory, and I started heading to my sister's. And I just wanted to talk to her about the news before, talking to my parents about it. Going along that road on Cheyenne, it was a misty day, gloomy, and it was, there was a sunflower field on the right-hand side, and they were really bright and yellow and big, and there's just a whole field of them in the middle of all this gray. I just got out of my vehicle and I started to walk out into that field. Maybe I was looking for isolation or something, I don't know. Just wanted to feel alone. So I went out there and I was walking and walking and just feeling all these emotions, and started to notice that my feet were getting heavier. And then I looked down and my feet were, almost practically stuck in clay. Knelt down and I just pushed my hands into the ground as hard as I could. And I pulled them out and I felt clay on my hands. And I was just sitting there at that moment thinking about how great that felt. All these fears and worries about what was going to happen all of a sudden sort of left. So we get to this base in Wisconsin and things just... You have full days. It's just nonstop training, and they have locations outside the base where they have fake towns, which have actors playing enemies and also non-combatants to run simulations. It was just like playing army in my yard at my farm with my brothers. So we'd have this patrol of 4 or 5 vehicles. You know, we got used to moving together, staying close. Our job was looking for bombs, so we would find and destroy bombs. I had gotten word that one of my friends, Juan Restrepo, I heard that he was killed. And then a couple days later, I was hit pretty bad. So I was driving and a rocket went right in front of my vehicle. And we stopped, we had the whole patrol stop. The guy operating the gyro cam in the back of my vehicle was looking around from where it came from. He picked out an area that he thought the trigger man's the guy who sits and waits until you are driving over his bomb and he
was a trigger.
But he sort of picked out an area of this. It's like a fortress. There's a bunch of buildings inside these big concrete walls. And there's a bunch of rubble, like destroyed buildings. So there's a lot happening, a lot going on in there. He told the gunner, who's operating a 50 caliber machine gun, to aim, shot a couple rounds, and sure enough, he scared the guy up. And this guy, what he was thinking, that he was wearing a bright green shirt. And the gunner shot him. We were going to go in to confirm it. I had this gut instinct to speed up for some reason. And a bomb went off underneath the vehicle. I remember feeling the blast wave come through me. It knocked our radio out. There's this big blast hole in between these two concrete walls, so nobody can come in there. We're trapped. We're stuck in there. We're next to these buildings. We don't know what's in them. We're looking around. We see things like pipes that are... It's just like a steel pipe with a sitting on a rock, and they can aim a rocket out of that pipe. It's smart. I was scared. I was so scared. I was like really sure that we were gonna get just that's gonna be it. That first one, that was scary. I felt impending doom. And after that was the only time I had a cigarette while I was deployed. We had to kill a lot of dogs. They would get hit by traffic. They'd be on the road suffering. Not only did we, want to put them out of their misery, but the bad, uglier side of that job is that the enemy might put a bomb in it and leave it on the side of the road, you know? I just want to talk about... I'd like to talk about Juan. He was, best at anything. He was the fastest. He would... When we would go on runs, he didn't even look like he would break a sweat. He was charming. He played guitar. And he's just a super nice guy. And out of every single one of us there, he was the best one. So it was really hard when we found out that he was killed. Because I just didn't think it would happen to him. My family never asked me anything. I don't like that behavior. There's a lot to be said, and there's a lot to just examine things that happen and question and have a conversation about. Maybe grow a little, you know? Both ways. But I had a lot of conversations with a lot of other people, even strangers. But not my family, still. Coming back is excruciating. We went back to that base in Wisconsin, and we had to stay there for two or three weeks and do paperwork. It was so stressful, because we were back, but we were still trapped, and we still had all this stuff to do. It was really hard. I could just feel myself crawling out of my skin, ready to go. Time couldn't have moved slower. I bought a bike. I bought a Bianchi Axis touring bike. I was never into bikes. I bought it, got these side bags, and I had a tent, and took, I got on and I rode bike to Nebraska from Fargo. I just didn't bring a phone, I didn't even bring an iPod or music. I just went to a Sioux hockey game. When they score a goal, they shoot fireworks up, and they, like, exploded right near me. And I freaked out. I had to leave. I just had to go. I just walked out. That was weird. I've never been to a Sioux game since. I found out from the deployment that if you have this gut feeling, you just need to go with it. Even if it's wrong, at least you believed in your own senses. That's empowering. My brother, he was taking ceramics at NDSU, and he sent me 15 pounds of clay. So that set me on the path to get a degree in it from NDSU. So I was like, where did the clay come from? NDSU, okay. That makes the decision easy. I'll just follow the clay. I'm just happy that I made that decision in 2005 to join the military. I think that taught me how to be a grown-up. It breeds adults. People grow up really fast. A lot of people, they might not know why they're joining the military, but I think that's why. Because somewhere under there, they're looking for a rite of passage. It's in the tribal, in a way. I have a dog now. I got to see what huskies are capable of, and they're so wonderful. Every night, at the same time, when it started to get dark, they would all just start howling as loud as they could, and do it for like 5 minutes. And they're letting all the other animals in the area know that there's a bunch of them here, so don't come over here. So they're protecting us. And that is a really beautiful thing. Their behavior reminded me a lot of the teamwork of being in a well-trained unit.
That was veteran Josh Zeiss, who served as a medic in the Army National Guard during the Iraq War. His story is one of many oral histories recorded as part of Project Unpack, telling stories, creating community, understanding the legacies of war. You can find out more or sign up to share your story at unpackstories.org. Veterans and their loved ones are welcome to participate. Our next story is from Rusty and Marilyn Ort. Rusty grew up in Frazee, a small town in Minnesota, and first joined the U.S. Navy in 1986. After his service, he started a business with Marilyn, but was later called once again to serve his country with the North Dakota Army National Guard. He remembers exactly why he decided to reenlist.
It was after 9/11. There was an expectation, I think, within myself to do more. And my wife and everybody said, really? Kind of like, really? You're going to do this? And I did.
And really meant he's 42 years old and 3 young children.
We went from making X amount of dollars to $200 and $300 every other week with the guard. But when I deployed, it was worth it. It was during the surge, and it was the right thing to do. I left before my unit and went to, it would have been White Sands, New Mexico. My unit and wife called me when they said they're getting ready for deployment. And we were starting to get the feeling, I and another, he was Master Sergeant, that things may be different than what we thought we were going to do over there. we boarded, and at midnight we flew down the Tigris and the Euphrates to get to where we needed to be, and we were the most eastern and isolated base, which took incoming mortar rounds, took incoming small arms fire.
Three times daily.
And when we dropped down, on Saddam's airfield.
What you were doing there was training the Iraqi soldiers.
I would frisk the soldiers before they came onto base with sniper towers on, and I'd have to go out far enough, make sure that they weren't wire-packed to detonate anything. I could email Marilyn, and we Skyped quite a bit. It would all be dependent upon outgoing soldiers and missions, and if there was a death, they killed all the power because they don't want it to sit there and say, you know, hi, if you were out. They didn't want you to all of a sudden, the soldiers know, and everything get out, get back to the family. And so they shut all communications down, and they would say, casualty. And then we knew what was going on. And then when they said back up, then we would have the opportunities.
But I think once or twice a week, no more than that, though.
Our talking was limited. My building was constantly hit, and we have a mark where all the tape is up, and then one side of the wall was hit one night, so we moved the exterior barrier walls in. And then that was hit by light gunfire and many, many mortar. I mean, you're going to the bathroom with your 9mm. Talking. I couldn't communicate, I couldn't facilitate, I couldn't get anywhere without my wife. Traumatic brain injury isn't always as visible. We can't always make the soldier have to prove, here's the injury.
People will say, well, he looks just fine to me.
Yeah,
well, live with him, spend some time with him, and you'll understand he's not who he was.
Purple Heart, which was done in a presidential demanded ceremony, so it wasn't just a 10-minute deal. It was with the governor, it was with the senators and congressmen, and then I received a combat action badge for engaging the enemy, and there's something in for the Bronze Star currently. And with the combat action badge, it's possible, with talking with the other master sergeant, he said you could have possibly received 17.
What was explained to Rusty is that for every, when you're, he was being mortar attacked three times daily for 17 days straight. That's where the 17 comes in.
Okay.
And then I received the military commendation.
Mm-hmm.
Medal. I received, I don't know, I put my medals in the drawer. In fact, I had asked Marilyn this morning and we found the drawer where I had put my medals. All good conduct medal. I was good the entire time, but.
Yeah.
There's a picture there with me and Karl Rove, the secretary to the White House for George Bush. A picture with me and Prince Harry. We had a very good talk. Then I have a picture of Ground Zero. We were on the set with Sean Hannity and Fox News. And I got other pictures where with Gretchen and Steve from that era. Up there is a letter from George Bush. I had sent him something and he appreciated it so much. And he ended up putting it in his presidential library. So it's on display at, I think, the college down there.
And what it was?
It was Sunsets in the East.
Pictures that from, were taken over in Iraq.
And the funny thing is, you think sunsets are always in the West. But when you're in the Middle East, your sunset is a whole different perspective because sunset's in the East. Cool. It's just kind of a different play on it. Over there in the corner is a very special guitar that was signed by Kiss. I was at an event at Moondance Jam, and two large men came up and says, "Are you Mr. Rusty Ort?" And I said, "Yes." "We're here for Gene Simmons. We're here to escort you down to the downstairs, and anything that you can carry, we'll do." And when I had down there, I had my own dressing room with Kiss. He had his hands on his knees and he said, "I go out on stage and do what I do, but it's a person that I'm not, but it's an image I portray. You lay your life to go out and die for me, and why do you do it?" And I told him, "I do it so you have the right to go out there for that hour and be who you want to be and say what you want to say." And there was a lot of emotion there.
That was Rusty and Marilyn Ort. Now, they both do a lot of advocacy work to help injured veterans get the care they deserve. This oral history was recorded as part of Project Unpack, Telling Stories, Creating Community, Understanding the Legacies of War. You can find out more or sign up to share your story at unpackstories.org. Veterans and loved ones are welcome to participate. Right now, the project has a special focus looking for stories from loved ones. You're listening to a special hour-long broadcast of excerpts from these oral histories. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Dan Nygaard doesn't have the kind of veteran story that first comes to mind. Pretty often, we think of those on the front lines first. But there are plenty of support operations that are key to warfare. Nygaard bounced around small towns in Minnesota before joining the National Guard. He shares his story of culture shock from growing up in the Midwest to serving in the Middle East. He talks about what life is like for the people serving who aren't necessarily seeing combat. And he admits that his desire to serve his country wasn't exactly selfless.
I was the last kid that you would have expected to join the military. I was a very artsy kid. I did a lot of art. I did a lot of theater and speech. I was very nerdy. I played a lot of Dungeons and Dragons and different role-playing games and different things like that. I was into magic cards. And from the beginning, I wanted to get the college fund, and that's what I joined for, was for the additional college money on top of the GI Bill. That was the plan, and I got out in 2002, and I started college, and then in, I believe it was March of 2003, was when the invasion kicked off. I was feeling kind of like something was incomplete, and I got out right before the war started, which there was kind of some lingering feelings like I had sort of gotten away with something, and I didn't feel good. I mean, I was following the plan that I had set out for myself, but I had a nagging kind of feeling like I needed to do something different. And the other thing that was pushing me in that direction was this was at a time when a lot of people were getting called back. I walked into the guard recruiting office over in the Morehead Armory over there. And one day we did all the paperwork, and basically that was it. I was back in the guard. And that was November of 2004, if I believe. And 2005, January, was my very first drill. The first time I ever been back in the military. I had my brand new, newly issued stuff. And that's when we were told we were going to ship out to Iraq. And so that was kind of an interesting start. And I figured, again, it was kind of, you know, it was not disappointing to me. I was ready to make that step and go. We shipped out in October of 2005, did 6 months of train up in Mississippi at Camp Shelby. And then after that, we went over to Iraq. Once we got there, aside from sand everywhere and just the complete barrenness of it and how desert it was, because I had never been in a desert before, some of the houses that we saw were very much no electricity. If there was electricity in some of these villages, it was a generator or two, or it wasn't necessarily part of the infrastructure necessarily. And it was poor, and they were very much living in a different era, I guess, historically, than we were used to. It was very much out of a different age. In some of the smaller houses, there wasn't really a bathroom in there. To be honest with you, I don't know what they did. I still can't quite... I mean, some of the bathrooms were regular toilets, I guess, but some of the bathrooms were just a hole in the floor. But there was electricity in one house. That was one of the weirdest, most bizarre things, was they had a television, and we were watching, like, I think at one point it was, if I remember right, it was like Western music videos. You know, like their version of MTV. I don't know, that always struck me as a little funny, you know? Kind of tough to just walk into that situation, but I did I did the best I could. I wound up being in a unit of amazingly, powerfully cool warriors that did an awesome job. And I did a lot of the support crap that was in the background. I was basically one of the talk monkeys. I mean, that's basically a guy who spends a lot of his time just running the operations center. And you're sitting in a room while everybody else is out there, kind of outside the wire doing this stuff. So for me, it was very much, again, I got back in because I wanted to do my part. And I did the best that I could. It was a struggle, though. I was not one of the star soldiers of this infantry unit that I was in. I ordered a lot of music, I remember, off Amazon, and I ordered a lot of stuff, just books and things. So many books. And then I had my mom, like, she sent me my guitar so we could sit at night and just play guitar or whatever. And she sent me a telescope, which I had asked for. The clearest, blackest nights you've ever seen. You know, you could see everything. There was no light pollution whatsoever. So we were watching Jupiter, and, you know, we were looking at nebulas and stuff. It was just dumb stuff to pass the time at night. We were extended. That was fun. We actually read about that and heard about it from our, like, from the paper and our families, just because there was some kind of a screw up. That was a tough phone call. That was a really bad phone call. Just to call home and hear your wife crying on the other side. I mean, finally, I can't even remember how it all happened, but we wound up leaving, and we hit the Minnesota border, and then we got kind of an escort, like the Patriot Guard riders, the motorcycle group. They basically accompanied our convoy. This is one of the best ever things. The whole trip back, it was just kind of building and building, and the radio was like, they're getting closer. And then we hit turnoff, you know, like 8th Street. It was like the streets were lined. There were banners, and there were, even from the overpasses on the interstate, there were banners, and throngs of people on the street waving, and they had signs and welcome home. And we got to the Concordia thing. We got in there, and everything I remember at that point was I couldn't hear a thing because of the crowd inside of the Concordia place was so just, it was like echoing off the walls of the sound. it was intense. Something I'm proud of. I'm just to have been associated with that group in one way or another.
That was Dan Nygaard with the Minnesota Army National Guard. You're listening to a special hour of Prairie Public Presents, focusing on stories of war. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Nygaard's story is one of many oral histories recorded as part of Project Unpack. You can find out more or sign up to share your story at unpackstories.org. Veterans and loved ones are welcome to participate, and right now there's a log of a couple dozen stories already recorded, but there's plenty of room for more, especially from family members. Family members like Christina Weber. Dr. Christina Weber is an associate professor of sociology at North Dakota State University. She is particularly interested in the long-term effects of war. In fact, she's the one who wrote the grant to fund Project Unpack. She tells interviewer Kip Thorson how her father's service in Vietnam went on to have many long-term destructive consequences.
For me, that was always just a big part of who my dad was. It wasn't something hidden in our family. He talked about it a lot, for better and for worse. And, you know, it was just something I always knew about him. It really drove my interest in understanding the ongoing impact of war on families and communities.
Do you know much about sort of your father's motives or why he enlisted in the military, or was he drafted? Or do you know much about the story of that?
There's two stories. One is that he often says, well, I didn't have a lot of options, so I thought that serving would give me some direction. The other one is that I was in a ton of trouble, and I was kind of told if I didn't go into the military, I could be in, you know, big trouble down the road. So he opted in. So he did volunteer to go. Yeah, it was all voluntary, although I think he regretted it. Boy, that year shaped his entire rest of his life.
What was the branch of service that he was in?
He was in the Army. He drove an ammunition truck around, so he was oftentimes alone, not quite in the units that some of the guys, I think, had. So he'd be driving the ammunitions in the hills between bases and things, so he would often be on different trips on his own. He talks about that a lot because there was some pretty dramatic things that happened, because the highlands were, there was a lot of real big fighting going on because the jungles were just hard. You couldn't predict who was there and hiding and coming out. So, and the fact that he's driving a truck with ammunition on it made it a very desired thing to catch and capture. So it was a pretty dangerous driving. Yeah,
and by
it had
himself.
Had to be pretty scary.
Do you know much about when he actually enlisted, what month or what year that was, and then maybe where he did his boot camp and training?
He gave me his book. They sort of do a little yearbook at the end of their basic training that, you know, shows all the things they did and pictures and stuff that they put into a little booklet. I want to say it was somewhere in Kentucky or Oklahoma where he did his basic training.
Did he go through his training and then was deployed pretty quickly, or did he have quite a bit of stateside time prior to Vietnam?
My sense is it wasn't. He went straight from basic training and right away they got shipped out to Vietnam. I don't know with absolute certainty, but the way he talks about it, he made it sound like it was all really fast from the time he volunteered, quickly then went down to basic training, and then was off.
Well, it's pretty clear that he did see combat.
Mm-hmm.
And what did he share with you about his combat experience?
You know, it's up and down, right? Because, you know, my dad faces a lot of issues. You know, he struggles. I mean, it wasn't till way later that he got diagnosed with PTSD, but early on, he was very, it was just something that was always at the forefront. And so when he would have, you know, fights or upsetness, it was oftentimes would come into discussion around the war. And so I do know when he was there, there was a particular incident where he was driving, and he had some other guys with him too, from what it sounded like, because he had to essentially kill a couple of people because if he hadn't, they all would have been killed. And he did get a Bronze Star for that. So, but he doesn't like talking about it, but when he's in his heightened emotional states, it would come out that he would talk about it. So I do know that was the main combat experience he had, and I think that's the one that has just not been able to leave him.
Absolutely.
Since then. So
sure.
When he was done, he did not want to have anything to do with the military again. He came home and, you know, got rid of everything. He was just finished with his service at that point. He didn't want to re-enlist. He didn't want to go back.
Do you know when he was officially diagnosed with PTSD?
I want to say it wasn't until the 90s, because I think he was just so hesitant to go to the VA and get an official diagnosis.
So your grandfather, grandmother, were they supportive of his decision to enlist, or what was their reaction when they, to your knowledge?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, my grandpa especially, because his service in the war, I think they both felt that that was a good route for him, given, I don't think he enjoyed listening to people. Authority has never been my dad's strong suit. And so I think they had hoped that might help him a little bit. My grandma, though, was terrified the entire time he was gone, and she would talk a lot about how hard it was waiting for letters, you know, and sending him letters and different things to just try to tell him about home. I want to say there was some recordings, but it would have to have been pretty primitive type of recordings that were back in the 60s. But I do know they had old, like, film, and so my grandpa did like having those little things to use, so I wouldn't be surprised if my grandma tried to record some things for him. But it was primarily letters, and I think it was primarily my grandma doing the writing back and forth and not my grandpa so much, but...
Can you describe just home life or...
Sure.
You know, the things that when the PTSD would surface and mm-hmm. situations would arise, what types of situations were they?
Oh, lots of fun stuff. I lived in what I would say was a pretty unstable house most of my life. My dad does suffer from alcoholism, and some of that's self-medicated. I do, learning more of my dad's history, I think there was some stuff going on even before he left that was already pre-existing, but definitely self-medicating when he came home. Unfortunately, I think he became really absorbed with that life in a lot of ways. So for example, things that would come up and triggers, he was obsessed with Vietnam War movies. Movies would be one of the worst things we could watch. I always dreaded it when I was growing up because I knew it would trigger something that night and there'd be a fight and a blowout. And my dad has a violent streak. So the alcohol doesn't help with that reality at all. So he would get really stuck in those memories and want to rewatch a lot of those movies. You know, Deer Hunter's probably one of the, it's a beautiful movie, but it's the hardest one for me to watch because of how much that would affect him and the things that happened after the movie. He would watch the movie in the house, and there were some pretty scary times. He confided in me maybe more than he should have when I was little, as you know, and he would sob, and I mean, it would be pretty intense emotionally.
How old would you be at this?
The earliest time that happened, I was probably about 7. So, yeah, very young. I know boundaries were not the greatest, right? I think about that now, and I'm like, wow, okay. So this was, yeah, really different growing up when I think back to all the things that I heard and saw. And you realize slowly as you get older what's normal and what's not normal, but it took some time to figure that out. But I was, early on especially, a fearless defender of my dad, and it was like, he's had problems, there's reasons he's this way. I'd always be explaining and defending why he behaved so badly. And
your parents, are they together still?
Yes, yeah. And I think they're proud of the fact that they are still together after 47 years now, I think. So it's which, for whether or not they should still be together, I don't know, but they are stuck together, and they're so dependent on each other. I don't think they could ever not be together. My dad went on disability and retirement fairly early, I want to say in the early 2000s, and my mom kind of started getting Social Security about 3 years ago, I want to say, 3 or 4 years ago.
Sure.
But she hadn't been working for quite a while before that, so she has her own series of health issues and things going on. And I want to say some of it's as a result of living with my dad. I mean, the PTSD he experienced, he certainly shared with her and helped her gain her own PTSD over the time that they've been together, just through the violence that she experienced with him and such in the house.
Was everybody in the house the recipient of the violence, or was it more directed at maybe your mother, or?
It depended on the situation, but there was a hierarchy, that might be the best way to think of it. My mom was always the first in line. My sister, as she got older, became also, and she was a little more rebellious than me. I was the people pleaser, so I got, and she was actually the one who would shield me from a lot of that. But she definitely got a lot more of that brunt than even I did. The other side of it is, part of my explanation is I'm my dad's only like biological child, and I feel like that has something to do with it too.
Sure.
Very scared. I was very scared of my dad through most of my childhood, and even adult. I probably am still scared of him now. You know, I went through this time when I was trying to get through counseling and things, and being told, well, maybe you just need to tell him how you felt. And I did tell him how scared of him I've been over the years. And he's like, well, I never meant to do that. That was the closest to an apology I ever got from him. That was never his intent. And, you know, he doesn't remember. His biggest thing is he just says he doesn't remember anything that has happened. So, which is frustrating, to be honest with you. But I get it. And I believe him. I have a feeling he doesn't remember a lot of that.
Right.
Between the rage and the drinking, I suppose most of it is pretty just gone in his mind at this point.
Your father was diagnosed with PTSD somewhere in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And did he seek help willingly? Was it more a matter of some kind of external coercion or pressure?
I think it was a combination. I think he was really struggling, and then he was having some health problems, and I think that's when he realized he should go to the VA because they would cover some of those health issues. And when he did that, it triggered a battery of tests and things like that, and then that's when it happened. He was diagnosed with hepatitis C, which is sort of connected to Agent Orange, they say, in some cases. When he got that diagnosis, he was told very explicitly that they couldn't give him any treatment unless he stopped drinking. So he did stop drinking around that time too, just because I think the fear of death got to be too much for him.
Sure.
And
is he still sober to this day then? Or
he is, but he hasn't dealt with things, I guess, that, and I hate to use this terminology, but I don't know what else to call it, sort of a dry drunk.
Sure.
So he still has trouble really dealing with the past, and I get it. I mean, I think dealing with some of that stuff could be a total breakdown of who he is as a person, so I would be, if I were him, I might be doing the exact same thing. So I don't say anything, any of this with judgment of him, but I am just being honest about the fact that I don't think he can come to terms with a lot of things. He smokes pot quite a bit.
Sure.
California, you can do that legally, and when you could get a prescription, and that's what he uses, I think, most of the time to medicate. Very scared. I was very scared of my dad through most of my childhood, and even adult. I probably am still scared of him now. You know, I went through this time when I was trying to get through counseling and things, and being told, well, maybe you just need to tell him how you felt. And I did tell him how scared of him I've been over the years. And he's like, well, I never meant to do that. That was the closest to an apology I ever got from him. That was never his intent. And, you know, he doesn't remember. His biggest thing is he just says he doesn't remember anything that has happened. So, which is frustrating, to be honest with you. But I get it.
Be frustrating.
Yeah, and I believe him. I have a feeling he doesn't remember a lot of that.
Right.
Between the rage and the drinking, I suppose most of it is pretty just gone in his mind at this point.
So how do you feel about your father's service, you know, looking back?
Oh, so mixed. You know, it's funny because when I did interviews with children of Vietnam vets, I was always surprised at how their first thing would be, oh, I'm so proud of his military service. And while that's there, that's really not the first thing I think of when I think of my dad's service. I think of, you know, and the sacrifice and all of that. And it's there, but I think what I think of is such a more personal thing where I think about how if it wasn't for Vietnam, I wouldn't be here, right? I don't think my dad would have ever met my mother. He might have just married that woman from high school, and I mean his trajectory would have been a life without me, I think, which so in that way I'm like, in some ways that service was extremely important to who he was and him being my dad and my father. But there is pride. I mean, I have a lot of pride in my dad in general for being a survivor of this experience, but I also think about, well, what would he have been like without that experience? You know, what kind of life would he have been able to have? Would it have been a better life? And maybe, maybe not. I don't know. Because who knows, he could have been in jail for some whatever trouble he could have gotten in when he was a teenager. But, you know, you also romanticize about how how it might have been otherwise. So I have done that over the years and thought, especially when I was younger, thinking about that. But overall, there's a lot of pride with it, but probably not the way in which other people think about that pride, just in the general, oh, my dad's a military guy. Because I never would call him that. I mean, I call him a Vietnam veteran, but military is not an identity. He's not an army man. He just doesn't want to be called that. So I think he carved out his own interesting way of being a serviceman, for better or for worse. Even he has come to realize some of what he's done. I think when he got the Bronze Star back, I think he realized, okay, the service I did meant something. There was some meaning to it. I think for a long time he felt like it wasn't meaningful at all. But I think when he finally wrote in to get his Bronze Star, that it sort of solidified maybe a little more pride in that. And not just the victim, because sometimes that's what he talks a lot about, is how he was sort of victimized by the experience. But I think he sees now where he... I mean, it was brave to do that. The fact that he thought fast enough to help out him and his friends and help them survive, I mean, that takes some, I don't know, I mean, it takes something to be able to do that, but it has to be a hard weight to carry in the aftermath of that.
That was Christina Weber, a sociology professor at North Dakota State University. She studied the long-term impacts of war for her PhD dissertation and is currently turning that into a book. Weber also wrote the grant for Project Unpack, Telling Stories, Creating Community, Understanding the Legacies of War. It's a one-year program funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can find out more and sign up to share your story at unpackstories.org. Right now, there is a special focus to get more stories from family members. We're going to end today's special broadcast of Prairie Public Presents with Amy Tickey. She has two brothers, both of whom are veterans. Their father was a police officer who was shot in the line of duty in 1985. He survived, but as Amy says, it had a dramatic impact on her older brother, Tom, who was just 3 years old at the time.
As he grew up, I know he really wanted to be a helper. As long as I can remember, he's always wanted to go straight into the Army. So when he graduated in 2001, he enlisted and was in August of 2001, and then September 11 happened. And the entire projection that our family had for his military career changed. I would have been 16 when he was deployed the first time. And I remember in some of the classrooms, I remember particularly in my English class, one day the teacher had, she had the TV on and it was the news, and there was video footage this and bombs that, and she was completely oblivious to the fact that this was really hitting me hard. But one of my good friends and a classmate, he just took me out of the room. He'd get a phone call once a month, and I had a little map of Iraq that I had up, and whenever I found out where he was, I would kind of mark it so I could kind of keep track of where he was. It's really, really tense small talk for the sake of hearing their voice and not knowing what to tell him. If I tell him about my day at school, is that going to make him feel guilty or like really miss home? Am I going to make him homesick? Within that first year that he was deployed, I developed TMJ. I found that I was sleeping and I would grit my teeth so hard while I was sleeping. I woke up one morning and I was trying to eat my cereal and I couldn't get the spoon in my mouth, because my muscles were so tense in my jaw. So I've had that since then. That developed for my mom as well. My little brother eventually ended up getting that too. And I mean, a lot of it correlated with the stressful times of Tom's deployments. I remember his first day back home after that first tour, and we hadn't seen him yet. Mom got him in the car and drove to come and see us so that we'd get to see him. And he was so tense in the ride, she said. And she was like, am I doing something that's making you uncomfortable when driving? And he's like, no, I'm just, every time I see a roadkill or something, I feel like it's a bomb. After he got back, I know he went out and he would go drinking. And he would come home completely hammered. I was so unlike him. He had seen a year of horror. I don't think he became the person that he was really supposed to be. My little brother told me a year and a half or so ago that I was the strongest because I had to stay behind. And I definitely don't believe that, but I do know that it was hard to not be able to take care of them. When my little brother did come back from his deployment, Tom did try to commit suicide. That was definitely the survivor's guilt, I think, for not being there for Nick while he was overseas. There's such a stigma that these guys need to be macho, that they need to be tough, that they need to be able to contain their own shit. Nobody can do that. You need to talk to people. You need to be able to get it out. He was done with church and that kind of stuff. It wasn't a thing he would do. It's a trend that I've noticed through my family for sure. After a deployment, that's not a place that they feel comfortable. Part of it for my older brother was the overwhelmingness of people. He felt trapped. I remember him going to church with us after his first deployment, and he started getting really pale and shaky, and he just took off out the door. I think there's also a lot of guilt. I know very, very little of what he actually did over there. I don't know if he's actually killed someone. He probably has. And I think there's a lot of guilt that comes with that. I do feel very blessed that with everything he's been through, how he's handled it, one of his best friends, he actually murdered his wife over an argument and stuffed her body in a deep freeze. And their two-year-old living in the house, and it was a couple days till he got rid of the body. I know that was PTSD related. You know, he cracked. It was an argument, and his anger had no outlet. I'm very grateful that Tom was able to be man enough to go get help.
That was Amy Tickey talking about the effects of war on her brother Tom. All the stories you heard today and many more are part of Project Unpack, telling stories, creating community, understanding the legacies of war. It's a one-year program funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. You can find out more or sign up to share your story at unpackstories.org. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Thank you for listening.